Hello and welcome to the IFRS Interpretations Committee podcast for March 2012. My name is Michael Stewart and I'm joined by Gary Berkowitz and Denise Durant to talk about some of the main issues coming up at the March meeting of the Interpretations Committee. First of all, just a reminder that the views expressed in this podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily those of the IFRS Interpretations Committee or the members of the International Accounting Standards Board. Changes to IFRSs are only occur after full due process of the ISB and the IFRS Interpretations Committee. So, the Interpretations Committee met on the 13th and 14th of March, and among the issues they discussed, one of the first issues they discussed was one relating to levies charged for participation in a market on a specified date, an issue related to IAS 37 and IFRIC 6, and something that they've looked at a few times already, and this meeting saw the committee really sort of bring to a conclusion its discussions in this area. Now, the issue related to levies that are payable as a result of participating in a particular market in a particular period or on a particular date, and in some cases relate to where the levy is driven by a measure such as revenue that was generated in a preceding period, so a period prior to the actual period during which there is activity triggering the liability. And the issue here has been all about when to recognise that liability. And connected with that, a question of whether, in some circumstances, a liability should be recognised progressively over the course of the year. Well, at the January 2012 meeting, the committee had decided to develop an interpretation. So at this meeting, the committee reviewed the draft interpretation prepared by the staff and concluded that the interpretation should address levies that are non-exchange transactions, so ones in which the entity is not receiving, for example, a license from the government, but simply it's a levy to pay. Looking at levies that are not income taxes, so not things that would otherwise be in the scope of IAS 12. And they also decided that interpretation, the guidance, would not address levies where the amount is calculated by reference to a revenue threshold. This had been a matter of discussion at the January meeting, and at the March meeting they continued the discussions in this area but concluded that the scope of the guidance would focus on other levies and not those linked to a threshold. So, as I say, the committee concluded its discussions in this area, and a draft interpretation will be brought back to the committee at the May meeting for voting on, and then the process after that will be that that draft interpretation would go to the board for the board's approval, and then would be published for public comment, and then later in the year the committee will consider comments received on that draft interpretation. Now, the next issue to talk about is another item that's been discussed by the committee for a couple of meetings now, and relating to IFRIC 12. Now, Gary, can you tell us a little bit about what happened at this meeting?
Sure, Michael. So again, just to explain what the question was, it was all about how an operator in a service concession arrangement in the scope of IFRIC 12 would account for payments that the operator is obliged to make as part of the contract to the grantor. And specifically, what the submitter was asking was whether or not that contractual obligation in terms of the contract to pay that amount over the concession term should be recognized as a liability with a corresponding asset on day one of the contract, or alternatively, whether or not that payment should be treated as an executory contract and therefore you would only recognize the amounts payable and the expense as they fall due. So that's the question in a nutshell. As you mentioned before, Michael, this one's been to the committee a couple of times. This is the third meeting when the committee discussed it. I think at all of the meetings, the focus has been more on what the accounting would be if the those payments were fixed or determinable on day one of the contract. So, for example, if I as the operator entered into a contract with you as the grantor that said that over the 10-year concession term, I'm obliged to make payments of 100 every year with just for the right to operate the concession or for a lease of land. The committee hasn't been looking at situations where that payment of 100 might increase every year based on an index or based on some kind of profit share. Now, in terms of the model that the committee or the way that the committee said that you can actually look at these payments, I thought we got to a very good place in terms of a framework for looking at this. And it's almost like a four-step process. So where the committee got to was to say, if you're in a situation where you have one of these payments from the operator to the grantor, the first thing or step one in this analysis of looking at the arrangement is to say, is that payment for a distinct good or service? So am I paying for something that is actually unrelated to the service concession arrangement? And if that's the case, then you would apply the applicable IFRS, you would pull that piece of the transaction out of the contract and you would account for it accordingly. If, however, that payment isn't for a distinct good or service, then you look into see whether or not that payment might be linked to the right of use for a tangible asset. And I think the examples there is in some service concession arrangements, it's common to see the contract written in a way that says that this payment that the operator needs to make to the grantor is in exchange for the right to, you know, right of use to the land that they are operating the toll road on, or a lease of the hospital building that they're operating. So a lot of the time it's linked to a right of use of a tangible asset. So step two in the analysis is if you have one of those types of payments, you need to assess whether or not the operator actually controls that right of use during the concession term. And that's the key aspect. If the operator does control that right of use, then that piece of the contract is, again, pulled out of the overall arrangement and treated as an embedded lease. I think that concept, I think, was, again, developed by the committee at a previous meeting, and I think we ran through that on a previous podcast. Then, so now we've gone through step one and two, so you've decided that this isn't for a distinct good or service and it maybe isn't an embedded lease. Then the next step is to actually analyze what type of service concession arrangement you have. And if you have the financial asset model under IFRIC 12, so you have a right to receive cash from the grantor, then where the committee got to is to say that concession payment is treated as an adjustment to the overall revenue recognized. So in other words, your revenue will be lower because of those payments. Alternatively, if the operator is in a situation where they're applying the intangible asset model under IFRIC 12, so in other words, the operator only has a right to charge users of the public service, then the conclusion of the committee was that payment actually represents an additional cost for the acquisition of that intangible asset to charge the public. And the one that was the most tricky, I think, of the three is if you're in a hybrid model. So if you're in a position where the grantor has guaranteed some of the cash payments, but you also have a right to charge users of the public, what we call the hybrid model under IFRIC 12. And there, I think we really, really need to look at the substance of what that payment represents. And the committee agreed that one of the indicators that you could use in doing that assessment is to compare the value of the financial asset or the in-substance guarantee that the grantor has provided to the overall services that the operator has provided. And depending on where those two numbers fall out, that'll indicate whether or not this payment represents an incremental cost for the intangible asset or it needs to be treated as an adjustment to the revenue. So I think we made really good progress in terms of kind of getting to an answer there. As I said, the committee agreed that they couldn't really address this without looking at the variable payments issue. And I think, as we mentioned on the last podcast as well, the problem is that the committee knows that there are related board projects that might adjust or amend their thinking thereon, and that's the leases project, because the leases project deals with variable payments as well, although it's in the context of a lease.
So how's the committee going to deal with that one then?
Well, I think in a pretty good way. They said, well, we don't want to stand still on this because we can't wait for the leasing project to get completed while folks need some guidance out there. So what the committee asked the staff to do is go away and actually do an analysis of how we would treat variable payments based on this framework that I've just gone through, but using the principles that we have based on the tentative decisions in the leasing project. So in other words, we're going to say, what would the accounting be for variable payments if we use the principles that are currently in the draft thinking for the leases project. And I think, the thinking of the committee there is we don't want to wait until the leasing project is completed before we start moving on this. Let's get everything ready from an interpretations point of view so that we're ready to help people as soon as the leasing project gets to a conclusion.
Great. So what are the next steps as far as the committee is concerned?
So the next steps are we'll be bringing a paper back to the committee at the next meeting to discuss an analysis of how variable payments should work using the principles in the leasing project. And at the same time, we're going to bring back a draft amendment to IFRIC 12 to take into account the principles that I just went through, as well as incorporating the staff's recommendations for variable payments.
So this really will be adding some supplementary guidance to IFRIC 12 to cover these particular payments?
Absolutely, yeah.
Great, okay. So that's two issues, one with a draft interpretation coming to the next meeting, and this one on IFRIC 12 with some draft amendments to IFRIC 12 coming to the next meeting.
Yep.
Then and the next item to mention, I think, is some tentative agenda decisions that the committee looked at for consideration at this meeting, both with some relationship to IAS 12. And just a reminder that tentative agenda decisions are just a sort of a part way through the process of the committee when it's looking at certain issues that it's deciding not to take onto its agenda. And so these are things which will remain as tentative and draft until so that they can consider comments that people might have on these issues. Now, the first of these related to the presentation of payments of non-income taxes. Now, it's really an IAS 1 presentation of income statement item, and the circumstances that the committee looked at that had been submitted to them was one where an entity is subject to two different taxes, one being an income tax and clearly within the scope of IAS 12, and the other being something that was a tax but not an income tax and therefore not in the scope of IAS 12, something, for example, like a production-based royalty payment. And the particular interaction between these two taxes being that the non-income tax, so the production-based tax in this example, is allowable, an allowable deduction from the taxable profit when calculating the income tax. And so the payment of the production-based tax is therefore a little like a prepayment of the income tax. And that was the scenario that had been submitted. So the question here that the committee was looking at was, should the expense of the production-based tax, should that expense be presented in the income statement as an operating expense, as would normally be the case, or should it be presented as part of the income tax expense line in the income statement because of this interaction between the two taxes? Well, the committee's tentative conclusion on this was that the production-based tax should be presented as an operating expense, as would normally be the case. And its reason for this was that, first of all, that reflects, in its view, the nature of the tax itself. It's a production-based tax rather than an income tax. Secondly, it observed that the guidance in IAS 1 and the line item that is identified in IAS 1 for income taxes is intended to include only taxes that are within the scope of IAS 12. And that it also observed that there are other expenses that are also deductions from taxable income when calculating taxable profit, and that this production-based tax should not be treated any differently from those other expenses. So collectively, those three factors led the committee to tentatively conclude that as to what the accounting should be and based on the literature already available. And so the committee tentatively decided not to take this issue onto its agenda. And so the committee's tentative decision is published in IFRIC Update and is open for comment until the 22nd of May. And so anyone who's got a particular interest in this area and views on the conclusions drawn by the committee and or the wording of that agenda decision is invited to write to the committee expressing their views on that tentative agenda decision. And the agenda decision, together with the comments received on it, will be discussed at the July meeting of the committee. The other tentative agenda decision that the committee reached was again connected with IS 12 on income taxes, and in this particular case was looking at a situation where in one particular jurisdiction there is a proposed tax regime under which the entity will be allowed to calculate its tax depreciation based either on the cost or carrying value of the asset concerned or on the market value of the asset. Now, usually the market value of the asset will be higher than the carrying amount, so an entity would be expected to choose that higher amount to get obviously a higher deduction against taxable profit and thus a lower tax to pay. And the question that was submitted was, how should the effect of the market value uplift for the tax depreciation purposes be accounted for? Bearing in mind that, of course, not only is this going to be a new change, but this market value uplift will change from period to period. So the committee considered this and it reached the tentative view that the market value uplift is the basis for the tax depreciation and that therefore is part of the tax base of the asset when considered in the context of IAS 12. And they also noted that IAS 12 requires that deferred tax is recognised on differences between accounting base and tax base, and that therefore a deferred tax asset would be recognised provided that the normal recognition criteria in paragraph 24 of IAS 12 are met. So the committee decided that based on the analysis and the available literature, it wouldn't take this issue onto its agenda, and so has published a tentative agenda decision which, like the other one, is open for comment until the 22nd of May. So again, if this is an area that you've got a particular interest in and have views on, please do write to the committee expressing your views, whether it's in terms of the conclusions reached by the committee or on the way in which the committee has worded its agenda decision. And those will be taken into consideration by the committee when it reconsiders this at its July meeting. Then the next item that the committee looked at was an issue related to revenue-based depreciation. Now, Denise, what do we mean by revenue-based depreciation?
Well, Michael, let me start by mentioning that questions about the selection of appropriate amortization or depreciation methods for specific transactions and requests to provide further guidance on the meaning of the phrase consumption of expected future economic benefits embodied in the asset have been common, and it's not the first time that we have addressed similar questions with the committee. So before I answer your question about what do we mean by revenue-based methodology, let me give you some background information about this topic, because in fact this meeting in March, this was the second meeting that we discussed this methodology. As I mentioned before, well, this is not the first time that the committee or the board have received these questions. However, neither of them have been really keen on telling constituents, well, this is the right methodology. Because as you know, the guidance in IAS 16 and IAS 38 allows entities to use their judgment and select the methodology that most closely reflects the pattern of consumption of the expected future economic benefits. So as I mentioned to you, well, for a change, at the November 2011 meeting, the committee discussed a request to clarify the appropriate amortization method for intangible assets of service concession arrangements that are within the scope of IFRIC 12. And well, the submitter at that time had asked the committee to consider whether a revenue-based amortization methodology better reflects the economic reality of the underlying contractual terms of service concession arrangements, or whether a time-based amortization method is most appropriate because it reflects the duration of the service concession arrangement and the fact that the entity received a license to operate the infrastructure. So in our staff analysis, we considered both methodologies, but we also incorporated a third one, a units of production methodology, which at the end, the committee concluded that this was the most appropriate methodology because it reflects the physical wearing out of the underlying asset granted to the operator. I think, Michael, that one of the most important results or outcome of this meeting in November was that the committee clarified that an amortization method should reflect the pattern of consumption of the expected future economic benefits of the asset rather than a pattern of generation of expected future economic benefits from the use of the asset in the business. So with this, you see the implicit conclusion from the committee was that amortization based on revenue cannot be considered an appropriate reflection of the pattern of consumption of the expected future economic benefits. So then at the November meeting, the committee directed the staff to propose an amendment to reflect this thinking. So while working on the proposed amendment, well, obviously we decided to explore the meaning of a revenue-based methodology because it's not defined anywhere in our standards. So we found, we did some research, and we found that some of the main features of this method is that it correlates costs and results, and the charge for depreciation is spread out over the useful life of the asset. And this is done in terms of the asset's relative productivity and or business operation. So we also explore the meaning of the term consumption of future economic benefits in the existing guidance in IAS 16 and IAS 38. And we found that a common way to identify a pattern of consumption of an asset is through its expected use, through expected usage of the asset. And we found that this usage can be assessed by reference to the asset's expected capacity or physical output. So that's what the current guidance in these standards, IAS 16 and IAS 38, tell us about. So you see, the latter led the committee to conclude, and us as well to conclude, that a revenue-based methodology is not really reflecting the use of an asset because the variations in productivity for a particular asset might not necessarily be coincident with the way in which an asset is being used up. And also, well, this methodology, this revenue-based methodology, is neither a method based on units or based on the passage of time or on a period. So then what we did is, and what we discussed at the meeting in March, is that we proposed an amendment to IAS 16 and IAS 38 to state that the methodology that reflects a pattern of generation of the expected future economic benefits embodied in the asset does not reflect the way in which the asset is being used up or consumed. And, well, we could infer then that this might be the case of a revenue-based methodology. So the plan, Michael, is to take this issue to the board to see if they will approve this proposed amendment. And we expect that with this proposed amendment, this will throw out some light on the selection of appropriate amortization and depreciation methods. And well, not that we're going to stop these questions in the future, but probably we will provide more guidance in this respect.
So, as you say, it's something that has come up again and again, this question. And whilst the committee and the board in the past have tended to feel that it's important that people are applying judgment, we feel that the time has come to perhaps provide a little more guidance in this area, given that the question keeps coming up.
That's right, Michael. That's the purpose.
Yeah. Okay, and the next item would be an item related to purchase of an interest in a joint operation. And Gary, what can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so the question here, I think just framing the question again before we get into the detail and where the committee got to, was how to account for the acquisition of an interest in a joint operation, and again, a joint operation in the context of IFRS 11. And I know, Michael, I always get confused between all the terminology, because the terminology has obviously changed in IFRS 11. So what we're talking about here is when you record your share of the assets and liabilities in your books as one of the parties to the joint arrangement. So this would have been called a jointly controlled operation under IAS 31. So I'm going to call it a joint operation moving forward, but that's the kind of structure we're talking about. And obviously this isn't a new issue, because we have these types of arrangements under IAS 31 today, where you might buy a share of the underlying assets and liabilities and it would be accounted for as a jointly controlled operation. So the question is actually, when you buy one of those shares, when the underlying joint operation actually represents a business, the question that came in from the submitter was to say, well, if I'm buying into a share of a business, should I apply IFRS 3 when I record those assets and liabilities that I now have rights to? And do all of the other principles of IFRS 3 follow as well? So should I record deferred tax? Should I write off my acquisition costs, for example? So that was the question, is whether or not you need to apply IFRS 3 when you're in that situation, or whether or not you could apply some kind of cost allocation method. So you just look at how much you paid and you allocate that cost to all the identifiable assets. Now, the committee looked at this a couple of times, and at this meeting, the committee decided that you should apply the principles or the relevant principles in IFRS 3, and that there should be an amendment to clarify that in the circumstances where you buy an interest in a joint operation, all of those relevant principles in IFRS 3 apply. And I mean specifically the ones that are the most contentious, or that I think people will be the most interested in, are, yes, you do need to measure your assets and liabilities at their fair values, with a couple of exceptions, the same exceptions we have in IFRS 3. The second thing is, yes, you need to recognize the acquisition-related costs as expenses in the periods in which they occur. Yes, you do need to record deferred tax assets and liabilities on those recognized assets to the extent that there are differences in the tax base and carrying values. And lastly, yes, you would record any residual as goodwill, which is another key aspect. So those are the main principles that you'd need to apply. But again, I think the committee is going to word it to say these ones specifically and any other relevant principles that might apply in IFRS 3. Now, there was also quite a bit of discussion around whether this principle would also apply in the venturer's accounts on the formation of a joint operation. So you and me get together, we form a joint operation, one of us contributes a business into that new operation. The question was, does this principle also apply in that situation? As I said, it was a lively discussion. I encourage anyone to go and listen to the playback. It was very, very good. But I think the committee ultimately decided that since this wasn't the question that was specifically asked, it didn't need to address this specifically in any amendment that it was planning on making. So that's where we got to on that.
So next steps?
Next steps. So the staff will present the committee's recommendation, which is, you know, as I said, that the relevant principles of IFRS 3 apply. And they've got the draft wording of that proposed amendment will be presented to the board at a future board meeting. And assuming that the board agrees with that recommendation, I think we can expect an amendment to IFRS 11. I think this would be a standalone amendment. It wouldn't form, because of the nature of the amendment, it wouldn't be an annual improvement.
Right. So it would be exposed as its own separate exposure draft, not part of the annual improvements exposure draft.
Absolutely. Yeah. So constituents would have the opportunity to respond specifically on this issue. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And Denise... I think one more item to talk about, and that's the item related to cash flow statements and classification of items in cash flow statements. What were the committee looking at this time?
Yes, Michael. Well, let me just start by saying that, again, this is an area where the committee receives many questions. I mean, the area on the questions regarding classification of cash flows are common questions that we receive. And the reason, I think, is because, as you know, the standard IS7 is mainly principle-based and does not refer to the classification of some particular transactions. So that's why we are getting these questions. So let me give you again some background information about the reason why we took this issue to the committee. Well, at the past November 2011 meeting, we discussed two issues regarding the classification of cash flows. These were the classification of cash payments for deferred and contingent consideration arising from a business combination within the scope of IFRS 3. And the second issue was cash flows for an operator in a service concession arrangement within the scope of IFRIC 12. So the conclusion from the committee for the first issue was to release an agenda decision. And this was because the staff's outreach indicated that it did not seem to be diversity in practice. And for the second issue regarding cash flows for an operator, the committee's conclusion was to propose an annual improvement that would clarify the classification of the cash flows and for an operator in a service concession arrangement, and these cash flows would be part of operating activities. So we brought these two issues to the board based on the committee's recommendations. We brought these issues to the January 2012 meeting. And the board look closely at these issues and directed the staff to ask the committee to look collectively at both of them, as well as to other previous issues on IS7 that the committee had discussed regarding the classification of cash flows. And the objective was to consider whether all these issues could be dealt collectively. So in other words, the board directed the staff to identify the rationale or the main principle in IS7 behind the classification of cash flows and determine whether this principle could be used to solve not only the two requests that we had recently for guidance, but also to solve future questions. So we did this analysis. We identified six issues that had been asked in respect to IS7. And also we analyzed the different reasons why these issues were not taken to the committee's agenda or why the amendments were proposed. And we did this analysis looking at papers since 2004. And we discovered that we have received a request for the classification of value-added tax, a request on the classification of expenditure on unrecognized assets, and also another issue on the classification of interest paid that is capitalized. So this is besides the two issues that I just mentioned before. And also there were a couple of requests for guidance on cash equivalents as defined by IS7. So Michael, interestingly, we found out that two different principles of classification exist in IS7. And these principles were both, for different issues, were used to support the committee's decisions. So either for issuing an agenda decision or for proposing an annual improvement. And so the first principle that we identify is that cash flows in IS7 should be classified in accordance with the nature of the activity to which they relate. So if you look, Michael, at paragraph 11 of IS7, you can derive this principle because it states that an entity presents its cash flows from operating, investing, and financing activities in a manner which is most appropriate for the business, and also attending to the definitions that are already in IS7 of operating, investing, and financing activities. These are in paragraph 6 of IS7. We identify a second principle, and this is that cash flows should be classified consistently with the classification of the related or underlying item in the statement of financial position. So the way that you can identify this principle is when looking at paragraph 16 of IS7, which states that only expenditures that result in a recognized asset in the statement of financial position are eligible for classification as investing activities. So this approach could also lead, we think, in some circumstances into splitting transactions into different operating, investing, and financing components. So if I can give you an example, if we, for example, test the classification of cash flows relating to construction services under a service concession arrangement, well, if we analyze this transaction under the first principle, we can infer that the activity of satisfying a service concession arrangement is considered a principal revenue producing activity. Thus, cash flows should be classified as an operating activity. Whereas, if we base our rationale under the second principle that we have identified, we could infer, for example, that under an intangible asset model in accordance with IFRIC 12, the cash outflows related to the construction of infrastructure are in reality investment cash flows. And the latter would be supported again in this paragraph 16 of IS7, because expenditures that result in a recognized asset in the statement of financial position, this is the intangible asset that you recognize under IFRIC 12, should be classified as investing activities. So, well, the committee looked at these two principles, analyzed them and discussed them, and observed that the primary principle, or the principle that takes relevance or prevalence behind the classification of cash flows in IS7, is that cash flows should be classified in accordance with the nature of the activity in a manner that is most appropriate to the business of the entity. So, the committee was in agreement with the first principle that I just mentioned. So the committee noted that it will use this principle when analyzing future requests on the classification of cash flows. And also, well, the committee recommended the board that it might probably be good if the board clarifies this principle in IS7, you know, to avoid all these misunderstandings and inconsistencies on the classification of cash flows. So what is next? What is the next step? Is that, well, as I mentioned before, we keep on receiving all these questions on cash flows. So our next step is to bring back to the next committee meeting some other fact patterns or examples of classification of cash flows for different transactions. And test all these examples with the primary principles that the committee has confirmed or ratified for the classification of cash flows. And then the following step will be to bring the results of previous discussions and this discussion to the board meeting to see if some other amendment is needed.
Okay, that's good. Thank you. So that brings us to the conclusion of our podcast for today. Just a reminder that the formal report of the proceedings of the IFRS Interpretations Committee is to be found in the IFRIC Update newsletter that is on the ISB website, that's ifrs.org. So please do look at that for details of all of the other issues, as well as these ones that were discussed by the committee at its March 2012 meeting. The next meeting of the committee will be on the 15th and 16th of May 2012. And just a reminder that the closing date for comments on the tentative agenda decisions is the 22nd of May. And finally, just a reminder of our usual disclaimer, and that is that the views that you've heard expressed today are those of the presenters and not necessarily those of the IFRS Interpretations Committee or the International Accounting Standards Board, and that changes to IFRSs are only made after full due process in accordance with the requirements of the IFRS Foundation. Thank you very much for listening.